It's the morning show. I'm Glenn Mobergen for Kate Archer Kent. Is there any limit to what the human body can do? Seemingly not if you look at the performance of athletes over the past few decades and their ability to break records that were once thought beyond the scope of human achievement. How is that possible when the human body has not taken a great evolutionary step forward in that time? One of our guests for the next hour thinks the answer may lie not just in the body, but also in the mind. Alex Hutchison is a former Canadian national team runner and the author of Endure, Mind, Body, and the Curiously Elastic Limits of Human Performance. Mr. Hutchison also writes the Sweat Science column for Outside Magazine. We also welcome to our airwaves Dr. Michael Joyner. He's a physician and anesthesiologist at the Mayo Clinic and one of the world's leading experts on human performance and exercise physiology. In 1991, Dr. Joyner wrote the first scientific paper on how fast a person could run a marathon. His guess was under 2 hours. So we'd like to hear from you. Have you competed in sports? Do you know someone who has? What do you think works mentally and physically for pushing your body to the limit in athletic competition? How much of success in sports is due to genetic factors? How much due to training? And how much due to mental attitude? Will we continue to see records broken in athletic competition in the years ahead? Or have we already reached the limit of what the human body can endure and achieve? And do you remember seeing an athlete shatter a historic record, and what was that moment like for you? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Gentlemen, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks,
great to be with you, Clint.
And Alex Hutchison, you're a runner. You ran on the Canadian national team, so you know about this stuff firsthand, not just as someone doing research on it. Tell us about your running background.
Well, yeah, I started running in high school, like a lot of people, and through university. And I made my first national team over 1,500 meters, which is a middle distance race just shorter than a mile, when I was finishing university. And I spent the next decade running track and cross country running and road running. And later on, I even did a little bit of mountain running at the World Championships. So I like running pretty much over any surface, any distance, and I still do.
Do you still run?
Yeah, I run pretty much every day. These days I have a one-year-old and a four-year-old at home, so often the runs are 20 to 30 minutes rather than the hour that I'd like, but I squeeze in what I can.
So for those of us who aren't runners, what do you get out of it, out of all that hard work and the excruciating pain of running, particularly in competition?
Yeah, that's a question I've asked myself many times, and I think that there's all sorts of brain chemistry that goes into making it very satisfying to feel good. There's a recent paper that just came out exploring why do people do things that are hard, and you know, there seems to be some benefit in getting satisfaction out of doing things that are hard, whether it's running a marathon or whether it's, you know, putting together a piece of IKEA furniture. There's been studies finding that people actually like the IKEA furniture if they've had to struggle to figure out how to put it together more than the same piece of furniture that if they got it just pre-assembled. So I think there's something deeply wired in us that makes us appreciate the value of effort.
Well, others, I think, would just get frustrated with the whole process. Tell us about your book. It's called Endure, Mind, Body, and the Curiously Elastic Limits of Human Performance.
Yeah, and this really grew directly out of my experiences running and just wondering, you know, had I gotten the most out of myself? Did I reach my physical limits, which made me ask, well, what are physical limits and what defines those? And I started to, as a science journalist over the last decade, I started to dig into the research done by people like Mike Joyner and others exploring the nature of limits. And, you know, there's a ton of interesting research, but the big theme that was sort of surprising to me was the number of ways in which limits that are really pretty straightforward physical limits often turn out to be mediated in some way by the brain. And that doesn't mean that it's all in your head and you can just choose to go faster, but that these limits that feel concrete are often a little bit more negotiable than we may suspect.
Well, let's bring in Mike Joyner. Michael, do you mind if I call you Mike?
Yeah, Mike is fine.
All right. You are a physician and an anesthesiologist at the Mayo Clinic. You're also an authority on human performance and exercise physiology. How does your work as a physician inform your work on human performance and exercise?
Well, you know, people always wonder about that because they say you're an anesthesiologist, so you spend your life putting people to sleep. But if you
well, let's hope you don't do that here.
No, exactly, Glenn. And if you think about it, when you put people to sleep, the anesthesia team has to kind of take over monitoring the body's vital functions and adjusting them as needed to keep the blood oxygenated, the blood pressure in the right range, the heart rate in the right range, and so forth. Well, when you exercise, there is an extreme challenge to the parts of the brain that are responsible for regulating what we call homeostasis. So body temperature, oxygenation, blood pressure, and so forth. So it's really the flip side of the same coin. My research interests are what happens when these systems are stressed at really their limits, and my clinical interest is how do we manage those things when we turn them off and people are under surgical stress. So it's a bit of the flip side of the same coin. So I think they do inform each other, and as we try to keep the patients healthy, but also understand the limits of human performance.
Now, is it true that you predicted that human beings would one day be able to achieve a marathon in less than 2 hours? Because we're pretty close to that right now.
Well, going back in medical school, I'd gotten involved in research and about the limits of human performance, specifically how fast people could run and what happened to something called the anaerobic threshold or the lactate threshold. And some ideas in the 1970s and 80s began to emerge about what the limits of performance were from a physiological perspective. And in the middle and later 80s, I started to ask what would happen if the same person had the best values for three key variables: VO2 max, which is like the size of your engine, the lactate threshold, which is the percent of max you can sustain for a couple of hours, and then how efficient somebody was. In other words, some people take less oxygen to run fast than others. And so when you look at those three things together, I predicted somebody should be able to run under 2 hours.
What do you see, Dr. Joyner, is the limits on what the human body can achieve, and how much of that is physical and how much of it is mental? We've already heard from Alex saying that we've got to look at the complete package here.
I couldn't agree with Alex more. Anybody who's been a serious athlete's had good days, bad days. People have had unexpected jumps in their performance. You watch people have unexpected jumps in performance. All sorts of interesting things happen like that. But I think it's a bit of a chicken and the egg sort of thing. So you have to have people with some ability. You have to have people who've done the training. But then on top of that is where the mental aspect comes in.
Well, we're going to listen to a tape here of some of the great athletic performances of the past few decades, some of which were record-breaking.
May 6th. British medical student Roger Bannister earned sports immortality, the first man to break the legendary 4-minute barrier, running a mile in 3 minutes 59 and 4/10 seconds.
So Bannister broke the record and made sporting history, and now John Landy has shattered Bannister's figures by running the mile in 3 minutes 58.
Terrific start by Daniel Bailey. Usain Bolt, though, getting into his running. Here he comes. Usain Bolt, challenged by Tyson Gay. Usain Bolt, 2 kilometres. Tyson Gay in second place. And in third place, the Safa Pal.
9.58! Smashing the world record! Unbelievable!
Well, the human body hasn't changed in the past couple of 100,000 years. We have grown physically in the past century, but that doesn't explain how much faster athletes have gotten. What's the most significant factor when it comes to athletes reaching a higher and higher bar of achievement over time? Dr. Joyner, we're going to start with you, and then Alex Hutchison, I'd like you to weigh in too.
Three things. First, starting about 1900, people really started to train harder and harder and harder until about 1960. And by 1960, pretty much modern training techniques had been developed with some additional hard work. Since then, there's been two main things, Glenn. One is equipment's gotten better, and you see that with synthetic tracks, or you look at Jesse Owens digging holes in the track at Berlin versus starting blocks. And then there's been increased opportunities for competition because people have longer careers. Competition is now worldwide, and because of professionalism. So I think those are the three main things that have happened: training, participation, and then equipment.
Alex Hutchison, what's your take on it? Why are people so much faster today?
Yeah, I mean, I agree 100% with Mike, and I think the population question is a really interesting one because you look at someone like Usain Bolt, who we just heard about on that clip. He's unusually tall. What is he, 6'6" or something like that? in most places, he would not be a sprinter. He'd be, you know, he'd be in the NBA or the NFL or something, or playing professional soccer. He happened to grow up in Jamaica, where his sprinting talent was discovered. And so you think of the percentage of the world that's competing. 100 years ago, it was, you know, 0.1% of the population had a chance to try sports. Now it's much higher, but there's still some untapped areas of the planet where people aren't competing. So I think Mike's points are spot on. The one thing I will add is, and a comparison that I think is interesting, is if you look at the records in racehorses or racing dogs, they've kind of stagnated in the last 30 or 40 years. The record in the Kentucky Derby is still Secretariat from the early 1970s. Humans keep kind of inching forward in almost every event that they compete in. And so that's again where I would come back to saying, once you've taken care of all that physical stuff, the mind plays a role, because horses can only race against, they can only race in that moment. They can race against whoever's in the race with them. Humans can kind of say, hey, Usain ran 9.58. That means it's possible for a human to run 9.57. And so we can set our goals based on what people have done before us.
Well, that Kentucky Derby record is still Secretariat. It's 159 back in 1973. And Alex, you write, there is a psychological incentive for human athletes to not only win races, but to win them in record-breaking times. The horse knows no such incentives.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And you know, obviously some horses are extremely gifted, both physiologically, but also psychologically. Some horses know they're racing; they're winners. But they can't race against Secretariat. Secretariat's not in their mental space. Whereas today's athlete, you know, can race the ghost of Roger Bannister or of Usain Bolt or whoever else has come before them.
The topic today is record-breaking achievement in sports and where the limits may lie for the human body. We're speaking with Alex Hutchison, the author of Endure, Mind, Body, and the Curiously Elastic Limits of Human Performance, and also with Dr. Michael Joyner of the Mayo Clinic. He's one of the world's leading experts on human performance and exercise physiology. I'm Glenn Mobergen for Kate Archer Kent. It's The Morning Show. We'll have more after this short break. It is The Morning Show. I'm Glenn Mobergen for Kate Archer Kent. We're talking about the ability of human beings to break athletic records and the interplay of the mind and body with Alex Hutchison, the author of Endure, Mind, Body, and the Curiously Elastic Limits of Human Performance, and Dr. Michael Joyner of the Mayo Clinic, one of the world's leading experts on human performance and exercise physiology. We'd like to hear from you if you've competed in sports. What is it that got you to achieve your very best? What do you think of this concept that it's not just physical, it's also mental? How much do you think is due to genetic factors? How much is due to training? And do you think we'll continue to see records broken in athletic competition in the years ahead? Or are we reaching a limit of what the human body can endure and achieve? And maybe you remember seeing an athlete shatter a historic record, or you saw a great play at a baseball game, something truly extraordinary. What was that moment like for you? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Our lines are wide open right now, so you'll be able to get in with no problem. Or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Alex Hutchison, I'd like to follow up on something you said in the last segment. You mentioned that back in the old days, in the 19th century, only 0.1% of the population would compete in athletic events, and we've got a much broader pool than that now. Talk about that a little bit more. What was that 0.1%?
Yeah, I mean, sports were a very elite pastime for a long time. And you know, it was a class thing, and it was a socioeconomic thing, and a geographic thing. The sports that we're familiar with today kind of came out of a relatively small area of the world, of sort of Britain and Central Europe. And, you know, there were huge swaths of the population that either didn't have the opportunity or they weren't allowed. There was a, there was this professional versus amateur distinction that persisted really up until the 1970s or early 1980s, or you could argue it still sort of persists in the NCAA today, where some people were allowed to compete and be eligible for records and other people weren't. So it's been a long process of discovery, of first of all, of changing the rules so that everyone who, you know, even if you are getting paid to perform, you're allowed to compete and for records, which has been a huge factor in enabling people to keep competing throughout their prime adult years. But also just opening up the sport and, you know, in running, which is the sport I'm most familiar with, the huge change of the last few decades is the emergence of East African runners who've rewritten the record books. And it's not that they weren't good runners 100 years ago. It's that they didn't have the opportunity to compete. And so the world's much more global today. It's hard to imagine that there's some population of super athletes that we're just totally unaware of. But you never know where a pocket of talent will emerge or where there's a few exceptional individuals who right now are growing up without the opportunity to participate in sport. So I think that's a big area for future improvement as well as an explanation of past improvement.
Well, we see that not only in track and field, which was once an exclusively, a province for all white individuals, but we've seen black individuals, African Americans, being able to compete for the first time in a number of ways. We had, of course, Jesse Owens competing in the 1936 Olympics and shocking Adolf Hitler with his first place finish. It was interesting too that the second place finish in that the guy who was right behind him, just a stride behind him, was Mack Robinson, who was the older brother of Jackie Robinson, competing on that same track. And let's listen to Jackie Robinson, who broke the color barrier in baseball. Here's some audio of him stealing a base.
Robinson dashes to the plate. It's close, and umpire Summers calls him safe.
Jackie Robinson stole home plate more than a few times. Not an easy thing to do, Dr. Michael Joyner.
Well, what's interesting about Jackie Robinson, besides his tremendous achievement in baseball, is he was actually, that may have been his worst sport. He played four sports at UCLA, football, basketball, baseball, and track. And he long jumped almost 26 feet, and he held the conference record into the 1960s. And he used to leave the baseball field and go over to the track and participate in two sports at the same time. So Robinson is a remarkable man in many, many ways, but he probably was a better long jumper than he was a baseball player. And if there had been professional track, who knows? He might have been more like Usain Bolt or Carl Lewis and won multiple medals over multiple Olympics in track and field.
Or like his older brother, Mac, you know, who ran right behind Jesse Owens. He ended up being a street sweeper later in his life with his silver medal.
Mack Robinson also had, I believe, medaled in 1932 as well at the Los Angeles Olympics.
So, you know, if you could comment on what Alex was saying, the pool of athletes, the number of people who can compete, is much bigger now than it used
greater.
To be.
And Alex pointed out, you know, the East Africans, but before that, right after World War II, the people from the, quote, West Indies, unquote, Herb McKinley from Jamaica, Arthur Wendt and others started to participate. The Eastern Europeans became quite good. And one of the most interesting things recently is in swimming. You know, swimming was dominated for many years by just a few countries, the United States, Australia, Japan, and so forth. Now there's swimmers from all over the world. We're starting to see African-American swimmers. And there's just been a growth of medalists literally from everywhere beyond the Anglosphere. And you mentioned, you know, world records. I had the opportunity last Saturday to see Caleb Dressel be the first man from the University of Florida break 40 seconds for 100-yard freestyle at the NCAA championship up in Minneapolis. And really everything comes together in Dressel. He's exactly the right size to be a great swimmer, about 6'5 or 6'6, I believe. He's obviously trained incredibly well. The pool is a high-tech pool. And in addition to having a beautiful stroke, his starts and turns are absolutely perfect. And so it all kind of came together, and he was the first man to break 40 seconds.
How did you feel watching that?
It was wild. I mean, it was literally awesome. You could feel the electricity in the crowd. swimming stadiums really don't have a lot of stands, but you're right on top of it. So people were anticipating this, and it was really incredible. And in some ways, he's a bit of the heir apparent to Michael Phelps. So that was also quite interesting.
1-800-642-1234 if you'd like to join the conversation. Let's go to Dave in Mount Horeb. Dave, you're on the morning show with Dr. Michael Joyner and Alex Hutchison.
Hey, gentlemen, thank you. This is a fascinating subject. I'm from the East Coast and competed in the Boston area kind of at the heyday of the road racing and marathoning, and got to see, you know, running races with Shorter and Rogers. And what's always intrigued me, and even from my college days where we had a reunion, is, you know, I was, you know, training 6 days a week, didn't have the benefit of a coach, but I would go and run a 10K, and I could win on a local level, but then I would run against the Shorters and the Rogers of the world in a race in Florida, and, you know, they were literally, you know, I'd run a 6 minute mile pace for a 10K, and they're at 5 minute, and they're that's a training run for them. So how does someone, how do they achieve that extra minute? Because remember, a lot of the distance running, it's also your ability to absorb pain. And how does somebody compete that much? It's very hard to make up a minute a mile. And how do they do it?
Alex Hutchison, let's turn to you. You're the guy who's run for a long time, and you enjoy it, and you've written quite a bit about the science of what allows people to push themselves.
Yeah, well, I mean, I should add, Mike Joyner is also a very accomplished runner in his own right, who probably ran in some of the same races as the caller. But, you know, yeah, how is it that one runner and two runners can train at a similar level, and one can be so much faster? The starting point, I think, before we get to the mind stuff, which I'm interested in, the starting point is there are just baseline physiological differences. Some people have extremely high VO2 max, so that means they're able to get oxygen from the air to their muscles very rapidly, and they're just born with that ability. And other people, and similarly, they may have the ability to respond to training in a very extreme way. So as soon as they start doing training, their body adapts quickly. And all of those things, you can't get anywhere without the training, but there's definitely just differences in how people respond, just like there's differences in height and other physical traits. So guys like Shorter and Rogers and women like Joan Samuelson or Joan Benoit, they couldn't get where they were without extreme genetic potential followed by extreme hard work. And then with the cherry on top is that, as the caller says, you have to learn to suffer. And there have been plenty of studies of pain tolerance in athletes versus non-athletes. And the general finding is that it's not that athletes don't feel pain. So it's not that these people at the front of the pack, it becomes easy to them because they have such talent. It's that they're just able to hurt for a little longer. And so they have the same pain sensations, but they're willing to tolerate it because over the course of training, they learn to learn these coping strategies to be able to become familiar with discomfort and to sort of treat it as information instead of as a reason to panic. So all those, any one of us may have two out of those three things, or one out of those three things. Guys like the people at the very front of the pack, they're checking all those boxes: the genetics, the training, and the psychological makeup.
And Alex, you mentioned too, and Dave, thanks so much for the phone call. Alex, you mentioned too that there are people who can dive and hold their breath for 12 minutes, and they have to overcome a subconscious alert factor, which is just, it's in all of us that when a carbon dioxide level rises to a certain point in your lungs, you want to exhale and take a breath.
Yeah, this is a great example from my perspective of the difference between warning signs and stop signs. That if you go for a run and you start breathing heavily and your legs start feeling heavy, start feeling uncomfortable, that's a warning sign. It doesn't force you to stop. And in most contexts, we don't actually hit the stop sign. But this breath holding thing is a great illustration of the difference between a warning sign and a stop sign. Because like you said, if I try and hold my breath after about 90 seconds, I will literally feel like I cannot hold it anymore. But that, as you said, that's a carbon dioxide. That's because carbon dioxide levels are high, not because I'm out of oxygen. And the guys who are able to hold their breath for, you know, 10, 11 minutes, they've learned to just ignore the warning signals and go right to the stop sign. But for them, it's still a factor of two. There's a huge safety margin in there between the warning sign and the stop sign. So for me, that's kind of, I like to remember that as a reminder when I'm feeling like I can't go any farther, that, you know what, I'm probably, this is uncomfortable, but I'm probably not at a true physical limit, because as the breath holding shows us, those physical limits are way farther out than any of us might imagine.
Mike Joyner, comment on that if you could. What allows some people to ignore those warning signs and others of, you know, for the rest of us, they're stop signs?
Well, I think a couple things, Glenn. Believe it or not, my colleagues and I, with a man named Zelko Duic in Split, Croatia, actually studied some of these breath hold divers. And one of the things that's most notable about these individuals is that they know how to both suffer and relax at the same time. And as Alex pointed out, people take these weird physical sensations or uncomfortable physical sensations, and instead of panicking or getting alarmed when they feel them, they use them more as kind of a dashboard or a monitoring system. And one of the things that the leading breath hold diver in Croatia was doing at the time was doing training seminars for business people and others to teach individuals how to relax under pressure. So one of the things you notice if you go to elite sport practice is a tremendous focus on form drills and also simulating competition situations, so people learn how to not panic and tighten up, and they, in fact, learn how to both relax and give a maximum effort at the same time. It's one of the great paradoxes of elite performance, the ability of these individuals to both relax and suffer at the same time. And there are specific form drills people do, the sorts of high-intensity training that they do, but it's all directed at this sort of paradoxical relaxing while you're suffering and interpreting these uncomfortable signals in as a dashboard effect or using them to monitor your performance as, oh, I have to stop, or, oh, this hurts, or, oh, this is terrible. So I think Alex really nailed it right there. And that's what a lot of training is about, especially at the very elite level.
Let's go to Wendy in Duluth, Minnesota. Wendy, you're on the morning show with Alex Hutchison and Mike Joyner.
Good morning. I am not an athlete. I'm not a couch potato, but I'm probably closer to that end of the spectrum. And I'm giggling as I listen to this because, you know, for me, it's 100% mind over matter. Several years ago, I had incentive to go on a bike ride to raise some money for a cause. So the night before, threw my bike on the on the back of the car, got on the track, and rode 80 miles, which was completely physiologically not something I should have been able to do. I ran a half marathon up here at Grandma's a couple of years ago because I had incentive to do so. But do I go running every day? No. But for me, it was a destination. I have to do this, and so I did it. But it didn't make sense that I was able to do it. It doesn't, you know.
So you surprised yourself.
Oh, absolutely, and everybody that knew me. but it was something that I my mind just sort of blanked out all of, you know, it hurt, very painful in retrospect. But I had to accomplish it. So I'm probably more like a lot of the listeners than the 6 minute a mile runner,
but it still worked for you. Alex Hutchison, this sounds very similar to what you had to do as a runner when you were pushing yourself to your limits.
Yeah, and I would say, you know, that's a great story, and it really illustrates the power of the mind. But I also think it's a great reminder of how much potential we all have physically that's hidden in there if we don't necessarily discover the right incentives that push our buttons. And so I think for a lot of athletes, what ends up happening is, you know, maybe in high school they or at some point along the line they get a chance to participate in a sport and they discover that they're good at it, and so they get positive feedback, whether it's socially or from their parents or whatever. And so they have the incentive to push themselves. And so they discover this potential that's within them, and it becomes something that they're able to access on a regular basis. But I think that potential exists, the physical potential exists to a far greater degree in you know, a lot of people who, for whatever reason, just because they had other interests, have not necessarily discovered it. So when you hear, I think it was Wendy, the caller, saying, oh, yeah, I just got on my bike and ran 80, you know, rode 80 miles. She obviously has tremendous physical capacity. Like, her body is capable of doing amazing things. And it's just a question of finding the right incentive for her. And I think a lot of people assume that they can't do these things. But if they're able to find something that motivates them to get out there, they might be surprised to discover how deep they can dig and how far their body can go.
Mike Joyner?
Yeah, Glenn, I couldn't agree with Alex more. Most people have no idea what their physical and mental capacities are in many facets of life. And we hear a story like that, and that's just somebody scratching the surface. And you see it all the time when people, for whatever reasons, get the bug. There's a well-known ultramarathoner in the United Kingdom named Steve Way. And I can't remember exactly what he was doing, but he was weighed about 230 pounds and was smoking a couple packs of cigarettes a day. And for some reason, he started to run, got the bug, lost about 50 or 60 pounds, and has run a 216 marathon. Obviously, he quit smoking along the way. Now, that's an extreme example, and he must have had some intrinsic ability. But stories like that are not that uncommon. They're just not that uncommon of people getting the bug and then doing incredibly remarkable things in many facets of life, not only sport, but also music, the arts, intellectual things, and so forth.
The topic today is record-breaking achievement in sports and where the limits may lie for the human body. We're talking with Alex Hutchison, the author of Endure, Mind, Body, and the Curiously Elastic Limits of Human Performance, and Dr. Michael Joyner of the Mayo Clinic, one of the world's leading experts on human performance and exercise physiology. I'm Glenn Moberg in for Kate Archer Kent. It's the morning show. We're going to take a short break. George from Monroe, hang on. We'll get to you right after the break. We'll have much more on this subject when we come back. It is the morning show. I'm Glenn Moberg for Kate Archer Kent. We're talking about the ability of human beings to break athletic records and the interplay of the mind and body with Alex Hutchison, the author of Endure, Mind, Body, and the Curiously Elastic Limits of Human Performance, and Dr. Michael Joyner of the Mayo Clinic, one of the world's leading experts on human performance and exercise physiology. We want to hear from you if you've competed in sports, or you know someone who has. What works for you in terms of having the mental attitude that allows you to push your physical limits? How much of success in sports do you think is due to genetic factors? How much is due to training? And how much is due to mental attitudes? And maybe you've seen some outstanding athletic performances in competition. You might want to share with us how it felt to be a witness to that at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Let's go to George in Monroe, who's been waiting patiently. George, you are on with Dr. Michael Joyner and Alex Hutchison.
Hi, thanks. I was in the Air Force in Florida in the 70s and running marathons. Over the course of about 10 years, I was able to substantially reduce my time. But the point I want to make is, I at that time, Frank Shorter and Jack Batchelor were training down there, and I was in two or three races that were out and back, where you would run out 6 or 7 miles and then turn around and run straight back. So the leaders were coming back as we were going out. And when Frank Shorter went by, it was like a bird. It was like his feet barely touched the ground. It was like his bones were hollow. in some sense it's a mutation. He had a physiology that, you know, I could run 150 miles a week for 4 years and you wouldn't even approach that, because there's the physiology at the world class level is a huge part of it. And that's my point.
Dr. Michael Joyner, let's go to you.
Well, you know, Shorter's an interesting man because he's an iconic figure, as George pointed out. A couple things. Well, all the great runners of that era were studied by a man named Dave Kossel at Ball State University. And what Dave found is that Shorter actually had a relatively low VO2 max for an elite athlete. But Shorter had tremendous running economy or tremendous efficiency. And I think what George is describing is the visual sensation of seeing a really, really efficient and beautiful runner just kind of skim down the road and cruise along. And that's really what made Shorter such a great, great runner, was this incredible running economy or efficiency he had. Shorter also ran about 120 or 130 miles a week. And once a week, he did 20 times 400 meters with a 200-meter jog in between. And those 400-meter runs were close to 60 seconds. So in addition to having this ability to be very efficient when he ran, Shorter certainly trained very hard. And after he left Florida, he moved to Boulder, Colorado, so he could take advantage of the altitude as well. So it all sort of does come together with Shorter. And he was notoriously mentally tough, as Alex has pointed out, in terms of the mental aspects of what makes a great athlete great.
George, thanks so much for the phone call. Let's go to Tom in Milwaukee. Tom, you're on the morning show with Alex Hutchison and Dr. Michael Joyner.
Good morning, gentlemen. I have been a cross-country skier for quite a number of years, and probably a little over a decade ago I took up biathlon. And I'm just really amazed at the ability of top-level performers to control their actual bodily functions, like their heart rate, especially like in the biathlon where they're having to slow things down. And I was wondering if you could address that, and what other sports have that kind of acuity to it.
Alex Hutchison, let's go to you.
Yeah, you know, I was saying all through the Winter Olympics that biathlon is my favorite sport to watch in the Winter Olympics because of precisely what you're saying. It's such a combination of going just, you know, as hard as you can during the ski, and then you have to be able to switch it all off. And, you know, an analogy you can think of is a basketball player having to hit a clutch foul shot, you know, in front of a screaming crowd. And the dynamic range of mental abilities you have to be able to rise to the occasion and push yourself and then totally relax. It goes back to what Mike was saying earlier about these breath hold divers being able to, you know, be rising to the occasion and pushing hard while at the same time relaxing. And I think, I think a lot of the great performers over the years have this ability naturally that they're in just control of their emotions. But I think it's something where we're gradually learning how sports psychology can help people get control of that, because most of us have trouble going from A to Z and then Z back to A, you know, so quickly. We're either all amped up or we're flaked out and relaxed. And so I think that's a specific, like an extreme case in biathlon of the having to go from one extreme to the other. But I think it's a sort of, as Mike has said, not just in sports, but in so many contexts, whether it's business contexts or social contexts, being able to control your level of arousal is such a valuable skill, and not one that necessarily comes naturally to us.
Well, and there's a very famous coach named Bud Winter, who's most notable for coaching John Carlos and Tommy Smith, the men who raised their fist in the 1968 Olympics. But Winter was really coached national champions at every event, and he's the coach of Usain Bolt's coach, his coach or something like that. So he's Usain Bolt's track great-great-grandfather. He was at San Jose State for many years, and he was a physical educator. In World War II, he had trained fighter pilots and noticed the people who were best at dogfighting were the people who were paradoxically relaxed. He wrote a book called Relax and Win, where long before anybody talked about Yoda, the Force, the inner game of tennis, or anything like that, Coach Winter had developed specific relaxation drills that athletes in every sport could use. And that book, you can get kind of an updated version of it today, you know, on Amazon or the Internet or wherever. But Coach Winter was there, and many, many people who are good at these things use Bud Winter's techniques, the form drills, the facial relaxation, focus on rhythm and technique and so forth. And he was truly a master and really at the very cutting edge of this long, long time ago.
Let's go to Bob in Pelican Lake. Bob, you're on the morning show with Mike Joyner and Alex Hutchison.
Good morning. It's an excellent topic. I was a coach, and this is a question I always wondered about, especially in reference to professional football. The mantra, or training mantra, was bigger, faster, stronger, and still is to a certain extent. I wondered if there is a maximum speed-weight combination that the human body can withstand in football, considering the many injuries we're seeing, especially in professional football.
I suspect Mike Joyner would be better at answering that. Mike, do you have any thoughts on that?
You know, that is really an interesting question, and some of the injury statistics are very closely held by the teams, but there you know, are concerns about that. I think the other thing is the turf and the equipment provides people the ability to really plant their feet, and you wonder about, you know, hamstring pulls, quadricep pulls, and these other sorts of things as people really get so big and so fast. And you have, you know, really these huge men, 280, 290, some of them 300 pounds, who maybe couldn't win a 40, but they could certainly win a 10. Some of these people are incredibly explosive. And you do, in fact, wonder about whether the muscles have gotten so big and so fast that they've outstripped the ability of the tendons and ligaments to really deal with things. So I think that's an area of just speculation and concern, but not a whole lot of hard data.
Let's go to Patrick in Madison. Patrick, you're on the morning show with Mike Joyner and Alex Hutchison.
Good morning, guys. How are we doing?
Good.
Good, good.
I just wanted to call in. I was a rowing coach and coxswain for 8 years over in Ohio for a little bit. And kind of an interesting thing that I noticed when I was training athletes over there was the balance going between long distance and sprints. For rowing, we would train for high endurance or high speed, and then we'd make that flip really quick in 2 weeks. I don't know if there was any techniques that you knew of about relating that kind of mental flip, going from endurance to sprints real quick.
Let's go to Alex Hutchison for that one. Alex?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting that it's a pattern that's observed across almost all endurance sports, and some people call it Matt Fitzgerald coined the term the 80-20 rule, or at least the applying this to sports, that even if the race is only like a minute or 2 minutes long, a lot of athletes spend 80% of their time training at a relatively long, slow pace, and then just 20% of the time doing shorter, high-intensity stuff, because it takes a lot longer to build your endurance and to have your body adapt. And so there's sort of benefits to spending a long time doing a lot of high volume training. Now, of course, when the race is short and sharp, you have to make that transition, as you said. And so you have to be kind of ramping up. You can't just sort of decide at the last minute, oh, darn it, I better do some sprint training. You have to be building that up gradually, partially because you have to prepare your body for the strain, but also because you have to get used to the different mental discomfort of high intensity exercise. As Mike said earlier, you have to rehearse it in training so that you're ready for it, so it doesn't take you by surprise. So there's a lot of different models of how you do that, but the sort of general periodized approach means that you're gradually making your training more and more like the race as you get closer to the race.
Well, we've been hearing from a lot of guys on this show. Let's go to Ann in Kenosha. Ann, you're on the morning show with Alex Hutchison and Mike Joyner.
Hi, good morning. I wanted to address the similarities between athletes and all other performers, music performers, dance performers. They all have to go through the same mental training and the same physical training. And often the difference between success and failure is their understanding of their body mechanics and whether or not they have a coach that really understands body mechanics and that mind-body connection. And I wondered if you could address that.
Mike Joyner?
Boy, I agree. I think, Ann, that's incredibly insightful. And I think if you look at elite performers across domains, you find some incredible similarities. if you look at their commitment to practice, people like Benny Goodman, Duke Ellington, and others, people, Stanislav Richter, really practice a lot. The dancers practice, and they simulate their performances in practice, and they learn how to do these sorts of maximal efforts with proper technique under tremendous stress, and they practice that so that they are then able to relax and really, you know, hit the performance when it really counts. I think that's incredibly insightful.
Alex, let's have you weigh in on this as well. You know, you mentioned in some of your writings that a lot of these great athletes read self-help books like The Power of Positive Thinking by Norman Vincent Peale. How similar is athletic performance at a high level to performers in other walks of life?
Yeah, you know, I agree too that the superficial, details of the task are different for in every, you know, whether it's sports or music or other things. But once you start shoveling down below the surface a little bit, the fundamental task of high performance ends up being really similar. And so I was, you know, as you mentioned, Eliud Kipchoge, who's the defending Olympic marathon champion, when I first talked to him, I was sort of surprised to hear that he's reading all these motivational self-help books. And why does a marathoner need to read The Seven Habits of Highly Successful People? But he's systematically trying to build up his self-confidence, his belief, and his ability to tap into his full capacity on the day, to be confident that when the, you know, when the call comes in the middle of a marathon and it gets challenging, that he's going to be ready for it. So I think in ways that I used to be a little more skeptical of, top performers are finding ways of tapping into that mental side of performance.
Alex, you've got 10 seconds to answer this question. What records are you most excited to see broken in the near future?
Well, everyone talks about the two-hour marathon, but I'd like to see the women's marathon record go down. It's 2:15:25, and it's been standing for a long time now.
Dr. Joyner, you're one of those people waiting for someone to break that two-hour marathon, so your prediction will finally come true.
Well, yeah, that would be great if that happens. But I'm happy to see exceptional performances by anybody under any circumstances. I believe it or not, I go to a lot of high school games, and there's nothing better than a high school game or a high school meet. And so I'm just happy when anybody gets a personal best and really is able to sort of relax and win, like Coach Winter said.
All right, we're completely out of time. Thank you, Alex Hutchison and Dr. Mike Joyner. The morning show is produced by Colleen Leahy with technical direction from Mike Derringer. Michelle Johnson is our executive producer. Coming up tomorrow at this time, it's the return of the newspaper moguls, how a few rich individuals are returning newspapers to their roots. I'm Glenn Mobergen for Kate Archer Kent. It's been a pleasure and an honor to have been involved in the conversations here over the past 3 days. Dean Kallenbach will be in tomorrow. Forward, as we say in Wisconsin. And thanks so much for listening.
Work it, make it, do it, makes us harder, better, faster, stronger.